Miles Davis. So what? Well, I'll tell you so what. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash, and we're Building Bridges. Now, migration as economic imperialism, how international labor mobility undermines economic development in poor countries, with author Professor Emmanuel Ness.
Well, Professor Ness, Manny, thank you for joining us. And let's begin to talk about the destructive phenomena over several decades of wealthy states, international development agencies, and multinational corporations forcing labor migration from the global south to the global north, as opposed to the self-laudatory capitalist proclamation of how its extractionist economy, well, it actually builds the economies of the host countries. Well, I think of it kind of like the vampire draining the blood, the life force out of its host. So get us started on this critical discussion of forced migration, which some say is advantageous.
Thank you very much, Ken and Mimi, and thank you, Mimi, for that question. It's great to be on Building Bridges. The Biden administration announced that they were going to begin a program of deportation of undocumented workers or undocumented workers and migrants and so forth. This just demonstrates the degree to which the Democratic Party and the Uniparty, if we can call it, is aligned with the capitalist interests, but also with those of the most pernicious and anti-immigrant and xenophobic forces in the United States. In this way, I would say that your question points to a contradiction. I guess from Marx's perspective, this book is arguing that there is frequently these kinds of contradictions. On the one hand, the United States and its corporations and its capitalist class, highly desirous of migrants as workers, low-wage workers. These are the people who deliver everything that we order. They are the people who are engaged in the most difficult kinds of jobs. They were the people who actually supported the economy during the most difficult days of the COVID-19 crisis. They are essential workers, yet at the same time, they're treated as if they are pariahs. And I think it's extremely important to recognize this contradiction that exists in this country. And I'd like to make this very clear point that in the United States, everybody benefits from migrants, including those people who are low-wage workers of all racial and economic backgrounds. And in different ways, of course, the capitalists are the major beneficiaries of that because they are the ones that make profits off of the extraction of surplus value from workers. The basic point, and I like the way you phrased it, Mimi, is that it's not that migrant workers want to come to the United States because they feel this compunction to be here, because, in fact, it's a very, one would argue to some degree, a place where people do not have services. People are denied the capacity to have homes, as we see here in New York City. People are denied even education and basic services. And so forth. Yet at the same time, they come here because they are, in fact, actually forced because of the degree to which they are impoverished through the tremendous amount of a debt that these countries actually accrue over tens and 20, decades and so forth. This is a continuous process, and it constitutes a form of neocolonialism that we really must recognize. In this way, I'm referring to neocolonialism as a kind of model that is based on the disproportional profits that are generated as a consequence of trade. So, for instance, the value of goods of workers who are in Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, or Honduras, maybe 1/30th of the value of that same labor that is in this country. So, of course, people are going to be forced to this country because their value is depreciated. And this is a process that has continued over the period of, over the last 300 years or so, especially when it comes to migrant workers from the global south, and I constitute the global south to be probably around 85 to 90% of the world's population. So if we're dealing with what is extremely necessary in terms of understanding the major dynamics, or as Mao said, the principal contradiction, that is the division of labor on a global scale between global north and global south, that creates a surplus value for rich people in rich countries primarily.
We are told, we don't go into the extractive nature of capitalism. As I said, I always like the analysis that was used during Occupy Wall Street, the giant vampire squid. I just think of it as a vampire draining the lifeblood out of these countries, whether people are forced here because of climate devastation, because the economy is sapped and there's the rise of violence, or there is the complete lack of jobs or just gross exploitation of the individuals, the labor force, as well as, of course, the resources are extracted from the country. So suddenly we are told, hey, it's not about the International Monetary Fund or groups like that plowing some money in to try to create perhaps micro businesses or things. Hey, these folks, when they cross the ocean, assuming they survive, they will work here. It is the cherry on the cake because they will get remittances. They will get money. They will get the all-holy American dollar. And then they will send that back along with barrels of goods back to the Caribbean basin or other areas. And that will be what is helpful to the national development of poor countries. So, explode that kind of cynical mythology.
Yeah, absolutely. That's you've said it again. In terms of the major point is that remittances are viewed by the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, international development agencies as the new form of global development, as if it were that exploitation of workers, migrant workers in North America and Europe mainly, are going to contribute to the national development of poor countries in the Caribbean, as you point out, or in Central America and South America, Africa, etc., Asia. In fact, that's not the case. I mean, if you take a look at the data, without question, it is a net drain of value from the economies of the global south. Give you one example, for instance, Ghana, a country that is in West Africa, which is a poor country that produces cocoa and has gold reserves and has a educated population. Amongst those educated workers happen to be nurses, trained nurses with degrees that they can take and go to places like Britain, and other parts of Europe, Australia, or even North America, and they work. And so Ghanaians go to Europe. And in fact, one can argue that, in fact, the generation of educating nurses in a place like Ghana contributes to the surpluses that are achieved in the West. So the idea that the international capitalist agencies, development funds, etc., are going to proffer, and they are proffering, is that that money will be sent back and contribute to the development of new technology that will allow countries to build, for instance, coffee processing plants, cocoa processing plants, allow them to refine their own ores and so forth, minerals and so forth. And in fact, that doesn't happen. What happens is that cocoa, etc., and all agricultural cash crops and minerals go to rich countries, and it's only there that those products are refined. There are very few examples. In fact, one point should be made is that the United States does not like it when companies emerge where new technology is transferred to global South countries, because they don't get the surplus that they would ordinarily get as a consequence. So they would rather have those goods refined in more wealthy countries. So really, workers have no choice in some respects to seek some kind of economic gain and maybe send money back to their families. Maybe they can send it back to their families to pay for privatized education, when in the past it was public education, to pay for privatized health care, to pay for essential needs that people require. But in no way do remittances contribute to development. However, they are it is a significant amount of money. And, you know, whenever people smell money, they say, OK, here's a lot of money. I would say in this context, almost $800 billion to $1 trillion that is transferred to countries where migrants come from. But with one caveat that I think we should all remember, most migrants come from poor countries, but most, a very large share, a disproportionate share of those remittances that go back are, in fact, people who are going from places like the United States to Japan or France or Germany or some places like that, and vice versa. And this is counted in the bundle of remittances. So in the United States, where we have a very high level of inequality amongst rich countries, the highest of all rich countries, without question, people go to France, or people may go to Japan or other countries around the world, and they may send back money to the United States. So it's only helping those people who are the highly educated, who are members of middle and upper classes. And this is especially true also for countries like India, where, you know, people say migration is the great hope, international migration. In fact, it only contributes to the further exploitation of workers in those countries. You know, certainly there is a degree to which there's new technological development, but who are the beneficiaries of that new technological development? They are, in fact, Westerners. So the people who do the accounting, people who do actuarial work, people who do IT work and so forth in those countries, the ordinary workers are actually fairly lowly paid, far low, more low wages than in the United States. Yet at the same time, it should be said that it contributes to a warped economy in countries such as India and the Global South and other places in Africa and so forth, because it's only a small segment of the population that benefits, and those benefits are a consequence of trade with the West. And, you know, for instance, in India, there are over 800 million people who are living in abject poverty. That's below the standards where, you know, people can actually get, 1,800 calories a day. So we're really witnessing a kind of doubling down of oppression of the Global South. And also here in the United States and other Western countries, where workers are, in fact, highly exploited. And I also think it contributes to conflict amongst the working class, which is not, it's really unfortunate in some ways, that we should be, in fact, supporting migrants and supporting their wages and jobs, their ability to work in the economy, rather than saying that they're taking our jobs away. In fact, they're not. The United States economy depends on labor throughout the world. There's a decline of fertility rates. There are people who are getting older and so forth who require care. This is another thing that, in fact, you know, we should certainly recognize, that women are one of the women are amongst the most exploited workers, because they are the ones who care for family members and so forth in the United States and other countries of the West, especially in Europe and Northeast Europe, where the fertility rates do not meet replacement population rates. So their rate of population is a net decrease. I was going to say the rate of population growth, but it's not population growth. It's population loss is what's happening.
So Manny, what should we in the United States do to further the development of what is now the underdeveloped countries, not in our interest. If you were in Congress or if you were in some place that you had the ear of the president or an elected official, what would you recommend that we do, not to just to profit this country, but to develop the rest of the world?
And I should say that we're speaking with Emmanuel Ness, author, professor of sociology and the like, about his book, Migration is Economic Imperialism. So Ken gave you quite a job.
He certainly did. Thank you, Ken. It's great talking with you again. First of all, I wouldn't be in Congress. I have no interest in advising the president or anything. I tell him to basically end, the entire government should resign and all parties should not run for office. As far as I'm concerned, the two major, the uniparty that runs government. So I would essentially, oh, that's a tough question. So I would tell, it's sort of a contradiction again, because I couldn't really say anything, because I don't really focus on it from the perspective of the capitalist class and their...
Yeah, we have to overthrow capitalism. What can you do?
Yeah. So, but what I would say this, that I think that they should actually, and this is a very bitter pill to swallow for the United States and for the world as a whole, but let's say just the United States, they have this supposed Green New Deal, which doesn't really exist for people in the global south, which contributes to actually... the decline in economies of the global south. It doesn't really contribute to green development and so forth. Earlier, Mimi talked about climate migration and so forth. That's a real thing. And so, in fact, what I would say is that, and again, what is the bitter pill? It's that Americans have to begin to stop driving their cars so much. They need to begin to stop using various forms of products that contribute to global warming. They need to cut back on virtually everything they do, their caloric intake even. I'm not saying that, in a way that, people should starve, but I should say that people should come and recognize that the United States is actually the major force behind the crises that are facing the world, in the sense that it is the major polluter and the major cause of pollution in other countries. So what the United States has to do is, reach agreements with the People's Republic of China around climate change, stop its belligerence in terms of foreign policy against other countries. Rather than that, the United States could spend a lot more money. The $250 billion that went to Ukraine or is going to Ukraine, I may, however people think about that, could be better spent in terms of giving that money to global South countries so that they can develop without any strings attached. So I'm not going to advise the president in terms of how to, in the short term, benefit Americans in terms of having higher wages, that I, in that sense, or economistic solutions. But, it's incumbent upon the leaders of a country. We're living in capitalism, but it's still incumbent of them to ensure that the world is safe for people, not just with respect to militarism, but also with respect to other forms of threats to the world, like climate. And, many of the migrants are in fact, coming to the United States because of climate, or they're going to Europe and other places, from places like Eritrea, Ethiopia, and so forth, to European countries because they're going out of desperation. Most of them don't make it. Most of them die on the way to their destinations. It would be great if the president were to ensure the safety of migrants, ensure that there were was housing for migrant workers, to ensure that migrant workers had education and health care and so forth. Because, in fact, we talk about a dividend, the United States is the net recipient of that dividend. It does not go to poor countries. So
sure.
I think in this context, Ken, I think we really have to recognize that we are an imperialist country. People like Jason Hickel and others have advocated the redistribution of wealth on a global scale, which essentially means that Americans have to live on less. But we could also redistribute that income so that we can live more equally, in the sense that there are many poor people in this country in any case. And that would contribute, you know, if people were, had access to decent housing here in New York City and other places, people had access to education all the way through college without tuition. If people had access to health care, which are all being eroded.
Well, let me pick up another point on that. I mean, clearly the issue is the primary dynamic of migration, as you show, is rooted in the political economy of imperialism and the super exploitation of the world's labor forces. We got that. We understand that people who are forced here are the recipients of terrifying xenophobic attacks and derogatory racist remarks. So what I want to know, and you do explore this in the book, the interest of migrant workers and workers of the global north, they are the same. So isn't it about both fighting against the same global capitalist elite?
Yes, absolutely. Without question, especially in countries like the United States, where you have so much income inequality, where people are, for a rich country where we have, you know, the highest level of inequality of any affluent state, that there is a common interest in increasing wages and so forth, and also wages for migrant workers. So, you know, the enemy, so to speak, is imperialism, and imperialism extracts from countries throughout the world. And it contributes to migration as a consequence of war, as a consequence of climate change and so forth. And workers in this country are also becoming more marginalized. And they do have some degree when they reach, migrant workers reach the United States, they are part of the U.S. working class. We shouldn't think of them as anything but part of the working class, whether they have documentation or they don't have documentation. And so the imperialist United States is a very destructive force in building class solidarity in this country. You know, they've broken unions over the last 50 years or more. I can get into that if you'd like to, in terms of strike activity, in terms of union membership and so forth. We all know about that. And but yet at the same time, the migrant workers are far more amenable to union organization and membership than are most workers. And so we should, in fact, coddle migrant workers and consider them not them. They are us. They are the workers who are serving society as well as other people are. And we shouldn't beggar thy neighbor. So in other words, we shouldn't try to think, you know, or I think it's wrong to think that by having deportation programs or harming migrants, that is going to help workers. Migrant workers are American workers of various different nationalities and so forth, and racial groups, and primarily from the global south, and they are us. And I think that's a very important point. I think we need to build and rebuild programs for solidarity in this country. Unions have declined dramatically, as I said earlier, but you know, we never should give up in the idea of building a strong labor movement, which also will be a way of eroding capitalist profits.
And we're going to have to leave it there. But you've said it, and you say it brilliantly in your book, the interests of workers of all countries, migrant or not, are found in uniting with their class against the parasitic rulers of the world. It's a must-read, Migration is Economic Imperialism, and we're going to have Emmanuel Ness, Professor Ness, back with us to then talk about some of the tendencies and indeed building international labor and political unions that can assume or think about assuming state power.
Thank you, Mimi. Thank you, Ken. I look forward to being back and Thank you for having me on the show.
And we'll be talking with you soon.
And we have been speaking with Manny Ness, author of Migration as Economic Imperialism. Thanks for the read and the discussion. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And we're saying continue to educate, agitate, and organize for our free Palestine. Thanks for listening, 'cause we build bridges.